Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you all for coming out on this rainy night. We just want to thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and for all the independent bookstores around the country. We're excited tonight to have Laura Lippman here with her new book, The Most Dangerous Thing. As many of you know, Laura Lippman was a full-time journalist at the Baltimore Sun while she wrote her first seven books. After leaving reporting to focus solely on her fiction writing, she authored 11 of the popular Tess Monahan mysteries and six standalone novels, as well as her short story collection, Hardly Knew Her. Laura has won many awards for her work, including the Edgar, Quill, Agatha, and Anthony, among many others. Now, will you please join me in giving Laura Lippman a warm welcome? Thanks.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here because there was some travel difficulty back east. My flight, which was scheduled to leave Baltimore at 11:10 Baltimore time, left at, I think, about 2:45. And they actually did the thing where we were on the plane, we were at the runway, and we sat there for 2.5 hours, and they had to take us back in because of the FAA regulation. And then they try to persuade you that you should really stay on the plane, but I did not. And I got off for about, and then we got back on, and this time we got out. And I was sitting there the whole time thinking, I believe if this plane takes off by 5 o'clock Baltimore time, I still have a shot. And if it doesn't take off by 5 o'clock Baltimore time, I'm just going to go home because I only live about 15 minutes from the airport. But I'm happy it worked out. I really wanted to come to the Tattered Cover, a bookstore that I revere. Very happy to be part of the 40th birthday celebration. And I've decided, just rather spontaneously today, by the way, because I know this is getting up and running at the Tattered Cover, for people who do read digital books, if you would read digital books on a non-proprietary device, that means anything but a Kindle, you can buy books digitally from independent bookstores. And I just think this is really important. I support all bookstores. I buy books in all formats. But, I'm standing in front of you today. How many years isn't it? 14 years into my career. I think I did the math right. 14 years since I started publishing because of independent booksellers. Because when you start out and you're a first-time author, it's independent booksellers who hand-sell your books, who help you find an audience. And I wouldn't be here to talk to you today if it weren't for story. And you don't need to hear this from me because you're here. But it's good to put it out in the universe, and I'm going to be putting it out in the universe more and more. I am that rare writer who likes to talk about where I get my ideas. I've heard that some writers don't like to talk about this. I've heard some readers say very seriously, don't ever ask a writer where do their ideas come from. And I think that's a pretty natural question. And I think it's a good question. I think it's an interesting question that kind of taps into creativity and where does it come from. Last year, the book that I published, I'd Know You Anywhere, I just have to be honest, that was a book where the idea came from a fit of pique because I felt I'd been snubbed. I felt I'd been snubbed by another writer, and then I had to sit there and listen to that writer give a talk on creativity, and maybe because I felt like I'd been snubbed, which, to be fair, could have been completely in my own head. But it was there. I felt snubbed. And then the writer began giving a talk on creativity in, I think regardless of how our interaction had gone, I still would have disagreed with almost everything she said, because we were in a room full of people on a rainy Saturday in Maryland, And these were people who wanted to write. And they had day jobs and they had families. I mean, I was them once upon a time. And I knew that what they needed was really concrete advice about time management and not feeling guilty. I've seen a talk like that given by the marvelous writer Ron Carlson, who tells people, you can write if you only have 10 minutes a day, but you have to give yourself wholly over to that 10 minutes. You have to shut yourself into a room. You have to turn the phone off, turn off the wireless, and just write for 10 minutes. And he talked about being the savage barefoot boy. You know, you have to be wild. And then later the editor comes along and civilizes what the savage. So I know this kind of talk exists. And what I was hearing instead was this thing that was so airy-fairy that I felt it did the thing that I hate, which is it mystified creativity. You know, I've been a writer for most of my professional life. I was trying to write when I was a kid, and every now and then I meet people who say, oh, I couldn't do what you do. I have no imagination. I have no imagination. And I say, really? What would you do if you won the lottery tomorrow? And they go, oh, well, and they have a story. That's imagination. Creativity is something that we all have, and we lose touch with it sometimes as we grow up. I mean, but you've never met a kid who doesn't have an imagination. You've never met a kid who isn't creative. And so I get very frustrated as a writer, as an adult, when I see someone putting obstacles between people and creativity and making it sound hard. It's not hard. It's play. It's fun. And if you make it sound like you have to go walking in the rain for 4 hours until maybe you're lucky, the muse will visit you and you will be inspired and filled with this. Of course, that's not going to make people want to write. So I was really angry sitting there listening to this lecture. We're now talking about the fall of 2009. And I thought, well, it would be very bad manners to just stand up in the middle of the room and say, I disagree with you and everything you stand for. So rather than do that, I said, well, I can't debate this person right now, but I can refute this person by having an idea for my next novel before she finishes speaking. And I got out a piece of legal paper and I started doing old-fashioned brainstorming with balloons, like books I like, Lolita, things I'm interested in, old crimes that no one else has ever heard of. And I just started covering this paper with these things that interest me, ideas that were popping. And it is true that I've taken a lot of inspiration from crimes that happened in the 70s and 80s in Maryland, sort of the pre-CNN era. So these are not very well known. So they, you know, when I put them out into the world, people don't go, oh, so-and-so. The people don't know these stories. And I was thinking about a crime in which there was a serial killer, pretty awful person. You know, I don't know why I feel the need to add that after saying he was a serial killer, but... and this particular serial killer had sex with his victims and then killed them. At one point, he had kidnapped what would be his penultimate victim, and he became very attached to that particular victim. And while he raped, and that's why I'm very careful and I don't ever give too many details because it does involve a living survivor of rape. He raped this victim, but did not kill this victim. Instead, he kidnapped one more victim and raped and killed that victim in front of his penultimate victim. And I've known this story ever since it happened, but for the first time I said to myself, what's it like to be that person? What's it like to be the person who survived? What kind of questions would you ask yourself? Would you feel lucky? Would you feel guilty? Would you feel both? And that became the novel I'd Know You Anywhere. And I really did do it, sitting there in 45 minutes with a legal pad. I don't believe in mystifying what I do. It's my job. I make stuff up. And I love doing it, and I've always felt that I do it better when I don't get too ethereal about it. So I'd finished the novel, I'd Know You Anywhere. It was gone. It was done. It was out of my hands. And now it's February of 2010, and it's time to have an idea. I mean, I, again, I don't think I deserve special credit for this. There's a publisher in New York. They pay me to do that. That's my job. And even though it's creative, even though I like it, even though it's filled with unexpected twists and turns that not even I anticipate, it is what I am paid to do. I would probably do it if I weren't paid to do it, but there's a job, there's a deadline. I have to take it seriously. So I went and sat every morning in the coffee house at that point where I was working in New Orleans, because I now have to live in New Orleans and Baltimore. And I drank coffee and I thought about what I was interested in. And I thought about books that excited me. And I started thinking about Great Expectations. And this, you know, the how it begins. And, you know, the idea of meeting someone in a dark and scary and terrifying place. And finding out in the end that this person is very different from whom you thought he would be. I began thinking about a series of novels that have used a really well-worn template. I don't believe there really are new ideas. I think we're working from a pretty finite group. And there's a particular idea that's been used a lot in the crime field. And it's about young friends who do something awful and agree to cover it up and never speak of it. It's a really well-known template. It's used by Lois Duncan in I Know What You Did Last Summer, but it's also used by Val McDermid, and the name of the book just flew out of my head. It was used by a British writer named Kevin Wignall, and it's used over and over again. We've all seen this story. We all know what happens. You know, they keep their secret for a very long time, but then it becomes apparent that someone knows the secret. And like, that's interesting. That's that, you know, what do I have that's new to add to that? What's going on? And I don't know that the next part actually happened. I've been thinking a lot about it. I think it did happen. It might have happened. It makes sense. And it's a good story, so now I'm telling it, and who's to say it didn't happen? I think someone walked into the coffee house in a striped turtleneck. Because why else would I start thinking about Freddy Krueger from Nightmare on Elm Street? I like the idea of horror films better than I like horror films themselves. If horror films were executed with less gore, I would probably watch more of them. I actually count some horror novels among my favorite novels of all time, in particular Peter Straub's Ghost Story, which I made the mistake of reading until I was finished, and it was 2 in the morning, and I was 22 years old and sitting in a bed in Waco, Texas, and I just had to sit up all night with the lights on, because I was really, I just count that as a singular achievement. I think that was amazing, and I remember to this day what it was like to read that book. So I like horror. I wish it was less gory. I'm kind of a chicken that way, but I do like the ideas that are explored in horror fiction. And I began thinking about Nightmare on Elm Street. It's probably not well known, but Wes Craven, the director of that film, went to the writing schools at Johns Hopkins University. I believe got his Master's of Fine Art there. And for those of you who don't know the basic idea of Nightmare on Elm Street, this guy, Freddy Krueger, is the janitor from the school who's been burned horribly, and now he comes back and he does horrible things to the children of Elm Street while they're sleeping. Why does he do that? Because he was murdered by their parents. True, he was a pedophile. He preyed on children. But he was killed in an act of vigilante justice and killed very horribly. But he doesn't come back for the people who killed him. He comes back for their children. And that struck me as brilliant. Freddy Krueger really knows how to exact revenge. So this is all like a stew. It's just bubbling in there. And I thought, so what if just one group of people with a secret, there are two groups of people with two different secrets that are tragically connected. But the problem is group A never talks to group B because kids don't tell their parents everything and parents don't tell their kids everything. And that was the book that evolved into being The Most Dangerous Thing. I have waited This is my 16th novel. There's also a novella. Started publishing in 1997. Really began writing in 1991. And I think part of the reason, Lisa, who was kind enough to drive me here today and take care of me while I'm in Denver, I mean, it's her job, but she's really nice about it too. remarked when I got off the plane that I was in like an amazingly high spirits for someone who had been in this delay. And I was in good spirits, and it was because I had cause to remember a delay that I was in 20 years ago, 1991, on a flight from Baltimore to San Francisco, where there was a snowstorm in Baltimore, and we were delayed for 4 hours. We sat on the ground for 4 hours in Baltimore. This was before there was an FAA regulation that they had to bring you in before 3 hours elapsed. And I didn't mind a bit, because I had a black and white composition book, and sitting on that plane 20 years ago, I began writing a very rough and very different version of the book that would become my first novel, Baltimore Blues. And when that plane took off, I had actually written 60 pages, all of which were unusable. None of which remain, but I still have that notebook. And it seemed like, you know, this nice full circle moment. When I started writing, I knew nothing. Luckily, I didn't know how little I knew. That's kind of a prerequisite to write at all. You can't begin to know how little you know. If you did, you'd never start. It's an amazingly hubristic thing to do. Look where we are. We got enough books. We got enough good books. We could all just start reading every single book in the tattered cover, and we'd have to live multiple lifetimes to get to them all. So the world isn't waiting. The world doesn't need me to write a novel. So the fact that I wanted to write a novel was incredibly arrogant. And luckily, I didn't know that. And luckily, I didn't know how little I knew about writing novels and how much I had to learn. But I knew a couple of things. I had odd little moments of wisdom. And one thing I knew is that the neighborhood where I grew up was extremely special, and that I needed to wait a long time to write about it. That I'd get one shot, I could use it in one book, and that would be it. The most dangerous thing is that book. I grew up in the city of Baltimore, within the city limits, but I grew up on the fringe of a wild, overgrown park called Leakin Park. It's bigger than Central Park, but it's hard to navigate. But of course, it's not just a story of a place, it's a story of an era. I grew up at a time when you walked out the door in the morning and you came back home for supper, and no one ever thought to worry about you. No cell phone, no way to get in touch. And I wandered those woods with, you know, absolute permission, and wandered my neighborhood. And so when I started to write again about the neighborhood, which is, it's known as Dickeyville, it's an old mill village, I wasn't just writing about the place, I was writing about the time too. And it is a very dark story, yet a Valentine to a place that I still love. I've tried to persuade 2 different husbands to live there. And since I'm sticking with the second husband, I guess I'm not going to live there. It's a really profound place for me, and unlike any other. And yet, sometimes the most specific things in the world are very universal. And the thing I didn't anticipate when I sent this book out into the world is how many people, basically everyone 40 and older, says, I had that childhood. I lived that way. I got to walk out the door and roam the world. And I'm not saying that's better. As a matter of fact, I think one of the things the most dangerous thing touches on is that some things do get better, and some attitudes do change for the better. And while we think everything just gets more liberal and more permissive, if we take a hard look about some of our attitudes, some things are better. When I was in college, for example, we understood that it was wrong for our professors to request sex in exchange for a grade. We're like, that's the quid pro quo, that's wrong. But we thought that an 18-year-old girl could enter into a consensual relationship with a 35-year-old professor, and that was just pure love. You know, nowadays, if you do that on college campuses, you get in a lot of trouble as a faculty member. But at the time that I was in college, people really believed that. It was like, oh, no, you can't make someone sleep with you for a grade. But if a student falls in love with the professor and the professor loves a student, that's just romance. No one recognized that there was any power dynamic going on. Nowadays, we kind of get that maybe the professor's got the decks stacked a little bit in his or her favor. That's just one example. This book is very dear to my heart, and I'm very glad to be out talking about it. But I think I've said what I have to say about it, and what I would really like to do is take questions, any questions about anything. I mean, you know, seriously, like about where to eat in Baltimore or something like that. I'm always happy to answer those questions because I'm really happy to be here. And, you know, I feel like it was an interesting journey of 20 years that got me to the tattered cover tonight, if I look at it in a very big picture way. Do people have questions? Because I'll just start asking questions of myself. Like, how did you get to be so fabulous? Just came naturally.
I have another question.
Yay, Kathy, what's up?
You said you're living in New Orleans and Baltimore?
Yes.
About half and half, is that how you're doing it?
For now, I mean,
It is because of Treme.
My husband, for those of you who don't know, is a television producer, and
he's fabulous.
And he is fabulous.
He is.
He is.
I mean, the best shows ever. Did you ever see Homicide: Life on the Streets? Mm-hmm. That was her husband.
Well, it was based on his book. He technically can't claim credit for that, although he worked on it. That we really have to give credit to.
The Wire.
The Wire, he did do that.
The Wire,
yeah.
Is David.
Generation Kill. Generation Kill, miniseries about the war in Iraq, and now Treme. I'll tell you about how Treme, this is, there's kind of a dark story here, which is...
I haven't seen it yet. I haven't got HBO.
Well, I think the first season is now on Netflix, or, you know, now rentable.
Right,
I think, I'm pretty sure. I think on the first date I ever went on with my husband, he said something about, and one day I'm going to buy a house in New Orleans, and don't you try to stop me. And at the time I was like, I've got no stake in this. I don't give a darn. But he really did want to buy a house in New Orleans, and he always wanted to live there part-time, and we traveled there all the time. And he was scheduled to fly into New Orleans to start looking for a house to buy there on what proved to be the weekend subsequent to Katrina. And what is kind of sad, and the way the world works, is that Katrina afforded the opportunity to make this TV show about Treme, which he and his writing partner, Eric Overmyer, had actually been talking about for years. All of a sudden, there was a story that the world at large understood, but they just wanted to go hang out with musicians. So,
yeah.
This is good luck. Because of the cost of insurance... Filming in New Orleans is prohibitively expensive, except if you try to film during hurricane season. So filming has to start in November and end by the end of April, which if you're going to spend time in New Orleans, that's pretty much when you ought to be there. But I find April too hot, truthfully.
Yeah.
So he's down there full time, October through April, and I'm down there a lot. And it's been very, because I'm such a Baltimore girl. That's where I live. That's how I identify myself. But I have learned to live in another city, which is kind of dangerous because now I'm like, well, maybe I could live somewhere else. You know, I never thought I could feel that way.
It's a pretty exciting city,
though. Yeah. You know, the funny thing about New Orleans is that I'm kind of a failed hedonist. I'm not really good at that stuff. So I like, you know, sometimes the people there just have such a good time all the time. They're so happy all the time. And it'll be like Thursday and the weather's nice. So everyone's already left work and it's noon and they're sitting at outdoor cafes and I'm trudging home from a morning of writing or trudging home from an exercise class. And I just want to yell at them all. Like, get to work. Life is real and life is earnest, which I can quote because it appeared in your grandmother's fiction over and over again. Life is real and life is earnest. Trust me on this. So, yeah, I'm living part-time in New Orleans. It's an adventure.
Great.
It's good. It's good. I mean, we all now know we want to do new stuff at midlife. Sir, in the back, I saw your hand go up.
I'm read The Girl in Green Raincoat each Sunday as it was published, each chapter. And I'm wondering, did you give them a flyer? Was it pre-written and fed it in?
That's a really good question. The Girl in the Green Raincoat, which is now in paperback form, originally appeared as a serial in New York Times. They give you an option. They say you can do it week by week. I believe Colin Harrison had done it that way, or you can write it all ahead of time. I said, oh, I'm an all ahead of time girl. I couldn't imagine the panic I would feel if I got to the... I couldn't do it live. I wasn't that confident. I plotted it pretty ruthlessly and got a lot, you know... My process, and I have to make fun of myself, my process, I do a lot of redrafting, and there's a lot of stuff I don't understand until I'm on draft 3 or draft 4, so to do it live was impossible for me. I really admired Colin Harrison for doing it that way, but I think almost everyone's done it ahead of time. And, I mean, the chapters were edited week to week. I would be having a... But I had done the whole thing ahead of time. So.
It made me wonder if you'd had a baby.
In 2008, when The Girl in the Green Raincoat had appeared, I did not have a baby, and I did not have... I might have had hopes that I might have a baby, but I had no reasonable expectations. Today I have a baby. I have a 15-month-old child. And that changed a lot. Yeah, Zelda's looking at me, and I know I never write about it on Facebook.
You don't.
I don't.
I asked her. I said because
when I
read
so.
Girl in the Green Raincoat, it sounded like,
you know, poor kid. Poor kid. She's got, you know, she's got this crazy dad. She's got this crazy mom. We're trying to let her have as much of a private life as possible.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I mean, I've talked a little bit about being a parent with this book because it did change how this book was written. Didn't change how I wrote about kids. Changed how I wrote about parents. I got all the empathy in the world now for parents. And man, this is hard. I mean, and really just sort of understanding things that, you know, this understanding, I think, that even people who appear to be the worst parents in the world, unless they're sociopaths, they want to be good parents. You know, everybody loves their own kids unless they're really screwed up somehow. So that did change in writing The Most Dangerous Thing. It was really different. And, it continues to inform my work, I think. Yes?
You mentioned serial killers and he being disgusting. Why do you suppose there are so many female serial killers?
Well, I don't really have a theory about that.
Well, I think in Baltimore in the 70s, could there have been one?
Ooh, I like that idea. Why are there so few female serial killers? You know, I don't know the answer, and I'm not sure that the question has been asked. I believe that the science that has been done on serial killers has worked from the known facts and developed a profile of what they're likely to be like, but I don't believe that anyone's come up with a causal gender link, or if they have, I don't know about it. I mean, I will tell you, I find in general, so... 16 novels, one novella. I mean, do the math. Okay. There's a serial killer that appears in my very first novel, but he's not actually important. And then I've written two novels that are about serial killers, The Last Place, and I'd Know You Anywhere. And in both of those, I stuck pretty close to what the classic profile of a serial killer is, which is a white man of probably below average intelligence. And I just felt that was important to be honest about what it is, not to glamorize it or sensationalize it or sex it up. I mean, the thing is I like reading about Hannibal Lecter. I've loved Thomas Harris's books, but when I just felt this obligation to sort of get it right. I don't know if it's the journalist in me. So, you know, there's of course the one very famous female serial killer. You know, actually Baltimore had a great female serial killer. And I think eventually she is in the book Homicide, and eventually I think they tried to do something on the show about her, but she was so bizarre. This was a woman in a poor neighborhood who took out insurance policies on everybody and then had them killed. And because it was a rough and tumble neighborhood, they were often not blood relatives, or they were very marginally related to her. And she believed she had great power. She believed that she could persuade any man to be in love with her. I think when she was finally brought in and interviewed by the homicide detectives, she believed she was putting a spell on them. But yeah, she'd had a lot of people killed. I mean, she generally didn't do it herself. She hired someone to do it. So maybe that doesn't make her a serial killer, because she's not committing the act, but she was, by the definition of being responsible for a series of unrelated murders. She's in the book Homicide. I've tried. It's interesting being married to a very creative person with a very high profile. He steals from me all the time, by the way. I'm just going to tell you that. Omar's signature song, The Farmer in the Dell, stolen from The Last Place. Because there was a moment in The Last Place where, when a character was embarrassed, someone said, the cheese stands alone. Shows up in The Wire, like immediately after. The other thing he stole from me, okay, this is a story about two creative. This is why writers should not marry. This should be. I remember when we first started courting, I said, writers should not marry, and if this cannot be prohibited by actual law, it should at least be frowned on as a social custom. I just remember we were in New York on the subway because I actually got out my phone and I wrote it into my phone. And we had had some conversation about what we believed about, life after death, if we were believed it at all. And I had made some semantic, nitpicky point. And he said something like, I've had a lifetime of you telling me how to say things differently. And I said, and now you'll have an eternity. My husband then said to me, do you always have to have the last word? I said, not necessarily. And I wrote this into my phone because it made us both laugh so hard. So flash forward to this spring, and I'm watching his TV show like a civilian, which is how I watch it. And there's a father and son having a fight, and the son says, do you always have to have the last word? And the father says no and stalks off. But I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Where's my writing credit? I want to get health insurance through the Writers Guild now. I contributed that line. But it is a little fraught for me to kind of go into his world. And we're trying to sort of have our separate spheres as much as possible. Anyway, thank you so much for turning out tonight. I'm really glad to be here and to talk to you all and feel very grateful.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.